This is Jeff Blankford with the May 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Those of you who regularly tune into Takes on the World may recall that I have been reporting on meetings between the Israeli and U.S. intelligence agencies regarding Iran that began taking place in Washington in the waning days of the Obama administration following the election of Donald Trump. What has been as significant as the contents of all these reports is that they originated in the English language editions of the Israeli press, which I monitor on a regular basis, and were totally censored by the U.S. media in all its forms, including NPR. There are a few American journalists who have been paying special attention to Washington's actions regarding Iran, and none more thoroughly than Gareth Porter, who has been a frequent guest on Takes on the World, whom I'll be speaking with again on that timely subject at 20 minutes past the hour. So stay tuned for that. One had to wait for last Friday's edition of the New York Times to find, on the bottom of page 11, an acknowledgement by the so-called paper of record that Israel had been the source for the so-called intelligence that has resulted in the escalation of rhetoric and threats of war by the U.S. against Iran and led to the very expensive movement of the aircraft carrier the USS Abraham Lincoln and a bomber squadron to the Persian Gulf to, quote, defend the interests of the U.S. and its allies, unquote, from a likely Iranian attack. Israel has been quietly playing an instrumental role in the recently escalating tensions in the Middle East, wrote the Times' David Habelfinger. In meetings in Washington and Tel Aviv in the past few weeks, Israeli intelligence warned the United States that Iran or its proxies were planning to strike American targets in Iraq. He cited an unidentified senior Middle East intelligence official, clearly Israeli, as saying. Israel also warned of Iranian attacks against Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, American allies that are enemies of Iran, added Habelfinger, presaging the unsubstantiated attacks that would then be reported on Saudi and United Arab Emirate oil tankers. The gathering cloud seen of a piece of Mr. Netanyahu's agenda, acknowledged Habelfinger, noting that, quote, he nearly took Israel to war with Iran in 2010 when he considered launching airstrikes on Israel's nuclear facilities, end quote. But he fails to mention that Netanyahu was reportedly stopped from doing so by senior military officials in Israel who thought it was nuts. But then, without providing any evidence, Habelfinger writes that Netanyahu, quote, has worked hand in glove with the Trump administration on his strategy of applying stiff economic sanctions to force Iran back to the bargaining table, end quote. Despite Trump's statements to that effect, there are few observers who are taking him seriously or believe, under the circumstances, that Iran will enter negotiations with anyone from his administration. A number of articles have appeared in the U.S. and foreign press suggesting that Trump would like to find a way of getting rid of his national security advisor, John Bolton, an unabashed hawk in Israel's behalf, who advocated publicly on more than one occasion before his appointment that the U.S. should bomb Iran. But doing so would present a problem for Trump. Bolton happens to be the protege of Sheldon Adelson, the mega-billionaire casino owner and the major donor by far to Trump's presidential campaigns, and giving Bolton the boot would no doubt be costly. According to a report in the New York Times at the time, Bolton's predecessor as National Security Advisor, retired General H.R. McMaster, a backer of the nuclear agreement with Iran, was fired and replaced by Bolton on the urging of Adelson, who also was adamantly against the Iran nuclear agreement and pushed Trump to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Adelson himself has called for dropping one and possibly two A-bombs on Iran, the first in the desert to get Tehran's attention, and the second on the capital if it refused to bow to Washington's demands. The movement of the USS Abraham Lincoln to the Gulf brought to mind that it was a young congressman from Illinois, the very same Abraham Lincoln who resigned from the House and chose not to run for re-election in protest against President Polk's decision to launch a major imperialist war on Mexico in 1846, telling the president that before supporting the war, he needed to be shown the spot on American soil where the first drop of blood had been shed. It was an impossible demand to fulfill, and since the U.S. was the aggressor in 1846, as it has been for almost all of our wars, and our historians then and now could do, all they could do was to make sure that Lincoln's opposition to that war would not be mentioned in America's school textbooks, and so it isn't. Notwithstanding the fact the United States overthrew another Iranian government in 1953, I should point out that Tehran has been in the crosshairs of Israel and a number of pro-Israel front groups in the U.S. and shortly after the U.S. invaded another of Israel's perceived enemies, Iraq, and deposed Saddam Hussein. The most well-known of them has been AIPAC, Israel's quasi-official U.S. lobby, which began pushing sanctions against Iran and whose staff members reportedly participated in the drawing up of the sanctions legislation against Tehran, as well as Syria and before that Iraq. Another is the Foundation in Defense of Democracies, which emerged the day after the attacks on 9/11 on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. You may have heard its director, Mark Dubowitz, interviewed about U.S. policy toward Iran on NPR or the networks or the New York Times or Washington Post, in which the foundation is identified simply as a Washington think tank. In fact, it has nothing to do with democracy, singular or plural, but judged from its activities, is singularly focused on pressuring Washington to push for regime change in Iran, and it has been known to work closely with the United Arab Emirates in getting the United States to do just that. A third is UANI, United Against Nuclear Iran, which was started in 2008 as a supposedly non-aligned lobbying group pursuing that objective by tracking and publicly exposing companies that were violating U.S. sanctions and reporting them to the Treasury Department. It was taken over by a new leadership committed to Israel's anti-Iran agenda in 2015 after its president and one of its founders, Gary Samor, quit the organization over its opposition to the Iran nuclear agreement, which he supported. Samor was not only replaced by Ron Hawk, former Senator Joe Lieberman, but his name was erased from the UANI website. The most influential of the pro-Israel organizations engaged in the propaganda war on Iran is the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It was established by AIPAC in 1985 with a view towards going beyond lobbying into the actual making of U.S. Middle East policy, and prior to the arrival of Donald Trump, John Bolton, and Mike Pompeo, it had been very successful in doing just that. With one of its founders, Dennis Ross, whom you have heard many times at NPR, having served as a Middle East point man for the last four presidents who preceded Donald Trump. Going back to 1988, that included both President Bush's, as well as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and if Hillary Clinton had been elected, she would have been his fifth. I should also note that Ross had been one of the founders of United Against Nuclear Iran, a very, really busy guy in Israel's behalf. So much so that another veteran member of Washington's Peace Process Brigade, and a one-time guest on this program, Adam David Miller, described Ross as Israel's lawyer. In addition, so-called experts from the Washington Institute are frequently called to testify before House and Senate committees on Middle East-related topics. It should be obvious from what I've just told you how instrumental the Washington Institute has been in seeing to it why nothing has been done on Capitol Hill to prevent Israel from expanding the illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank, or interfering either with its wars or air raids on Gaza, or its 12-year siege of that impoverished, densely populated strip, despite the World Health Organization having declared it to be a humanitarian disaster. When it comes to Iran, there is no daylight between any of the pro-Israel organizations, and the Washington Institute has been one of those pushing for the hardest line. With reports of alleged minor attacks on oil tankers owned by the Saudis or United Arab Emirates, real or invented, which are being blamed directly or indirectly on Iran, I thought it would be well to replay for you a short segment from the question period at an event at the Washington Institute in 2012, in which a speaker, Patrick Clawson, an official of the organization, is asked about the possibility of starting a war with Iran and of employing a false flag operation to initiate it. So let's listen to Patrick Clawson responding.
That compromise is not company. That the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II. As David mentioned, you may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall we had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We can do a variety of things if we wish to increase the pressure. I'm not advocating that, but I'm just suggesting that this is not a either-or proposition of, you know, it's just sanctions has to succeed or other things. We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. We could get nastier than that. Compromise is not coming.
And that was Patrick Lawson. He is currently the Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a Senior Editor of Middle East Quarterly. Well, who wasn't buying the so-called warnings that the Iranians were planning to stir things up in Iraq by having their so-called proxies, Shia militias that had been previously engaged in fighting ISIS, attack U.S. targets? Was a British general familiar with the scene, he's on the scene, who told reporters gathered at the Pentagon last Tuesday that, quote, there's been no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in the region. We monitor them with a whole range of others because that's the environment we're in, said Major General Chris Geeka, speaking via video from Baghdad. If the threat level seems to go up, then we'll raise our force protection measures accordingly, end quote. Apparently eager to quash the British general's remarks, the U.S. Central Command issued a statement just hours later, disputing Geeka's comments and repeating Bolton's unsubstantiated claims that American intelligence has, quote, identified credible threats from, quote, Iranian-backed forces in Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to cope with serious legal problems that seem to put him in the same position as his good friend Donald Trump. According to the Times of Israel, citing a report on Israeli TV a week ago, Netanyahu has decided to advance legislation that will ensure he cannot be prosecuted for any crimes so long as he remains in office, and has begun briefing his Likud party's Knesset members on how to, quote-unquote, sell the move to the Israeli public. Having previously given mixed signals about whether he would seek to pass legislation in order to evade prosecution in the three criminal cases for which he faces indictment, Netanyahu has now taken the firm decision to push legislation to guarantee himself immunity from prosecution, the Channel 12 Israeli television station report said. The legislation has reportedly been discussed in the current negotiations on the formation of Netanyahu's new coalition government. Netanyahu and members of his close circle reportedly have begun briefing Likud members of the Knesset on how to market this to the public. They are being told to highlight the fact that voters re-elected Netanyahu last month, even though they knew all about the allegations against him, and that he should thus be empowered to see out his time in office and deal with entanglements only after stepping down. The TV report quoted what it said was Netanyahu's message to this effect, that is being conveyed to the Likud members of the Knesset in order for them to advocate on his behalf, saying in essence, quote, the citizens of Israel deserve a full prime-time prime minister. I'll deal with my legal issues when I've completed my term as prime minister. The citizens of Israel knew about my legal situation and elected me. If I was focused on my personal best interest, I'd manage my legal battle as prime minister and not as an ordinary citizen, but I recognize that this is not in the best interest of the state. End quote. Well, those would be Netanyahu's talking points, a more literate but no less corrupt version of what we have seen in the White House. The report said Netanyahu is yet to decide how wide-ranging legislation to secure his immunity should be. He could seek to advance a version of the so-called French law under which a prime minister could not be prosecuted while in office, or try to amend existing legislation in order for immunity from prosecution to be automatically granted to all members of the Knesset. And he could back up such moves with legislation to override the Supreme Court's authority to challenge a Knesset immunity decision, legislation that would be part of a constitutional revolution dramatically curbing the Supreme Court's powers. At this stage, the TV report said, Netanyahu had not made a final decision in this regard. And amid early reports of his legislative plans, Netanyahu Monday had railed at what he called, quote, misleading and distorted media coverage, according to which he was seeking to nullify the Supreme Court's powers. Trump's advantage over Netanyahu is that he has the Supreme Court in his pocket. There have been frequently, in the last few years, a number of Israeli legislators who have attacked the Supreme Court because it seems to overturn certain decisions that the ultra-right wing government and legislators in Israel want to enforce, mostly against the Palestinians. And unlike the United States, Israel has no formal constitution. It has a number of basic laws that have been in place since Israel came into being, but one of the promises that it made and never fulfilled to the United Nations was that it was going to produce a constitution. One of the reasons that it is not, according to Israel's Israeli critics, is that it would establish the differences or similarities in the laws protecting both Israel's Jewish citizens and its Arab citizens. And at the moment, that is not, even though the Israeli propaganda machine will tell you that Israel's Arab citizens are treated equally and that they're members of the Arabs in the Knesset, the reality of Arab life on the ground in Israel is not equal to that of Jewish life in Israel. As a matter of fact, for the first 18 years of Israel's existence, the Palestinian Arab community that remained in Israel was under military government. It was only in the months, about the 9 months preceding the 1967 war, where Israel actually formally had what might be called loosely a democracy. And of course, immediately after the Six-Day War, when they occupied the West Bank and Gaza and controlled everything from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, it has been ipso facto an apartheid state with Israeli Jews and then Jewish settlers having certain rights that the Palestinians, certainly in the West Bank and Gaza, never had, and those inside Israel only had in a limited way before 1967, and in a limited way today, although certainly more than Palestinians have in the West Bank. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.